Now, this hour, we are going to talk about the Lizzie Borden case. We are right now in the process of trying to get a hold of our guest, Richard Sennett. And, you know, he's on the West Coast, so hopefully he hasn't gotten his times mixed up. But he did confirm that he would be with us this hour. He and Debbie Sennett are the authors of this new book, Shocking Psychic Solution, The Lizzie Borden Case. And if you don't know anything about Lizzie Borden, I'll tell you a bit about what I know regarding this case. It happened in 1892, and Lizzie and her sister Emma were living in the house with their father, named Andrew, and stepmother. And the stepmother was not very well liked by the two daughters, but Lizzie and Emma, they wanted apparently a piece of their father's fortune, because their father was a very rich man. Sometimes he was considered a slumlord. He owned a lot of the areas where the property value was not so high, but he would tax people extremely. And so, basically, I don't want to give you all the details of the case until we get Richard, because he's the expert. Maybe we'll get him, maybe we won't. I mean, sometimes at live radio this happens, but ultimately, the father and the stepmother ended up hacked to pieces with a hatchet. And that's where the urban sort of nursery rhyme comes from. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. And when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. This was an enormous case because it was so gruesome, especially at that time. In the book by Richard Sennett, there are some very ghoulish pictures that show these hacked up bodies. In fact, I'm showing one to Rob right now, and you can barely even recognize that as a human.
No, but it looks cool.
And apparently what Richard and Debbie Sennett have done is gone to the location where this occurred. They looked over all the evidence. They looked at all the pictures. They tried to use psychometry and a variety of other methods to look at anything that might give them a clue as to what happened. I'm looking right now at a picture of Andrew, Lizzie Borden's father. He slumped over a horsehair couch. His head is so disfigured and bashed, it's unrecognizable. The stepmother, Abby, she is lying face down, also hacked to pieces. These are pictures that kind of remind me of the Jack the Ripper pictures that you may have seen, where these faces are just so mangled that you can hardly tell what you're looking at here. In fact, this is a really gruesome one. Check that out, Rob.
Yeah, okay. I was hoping to sleep well tonight, but okay.
Yeah, this is somebody's face. I'm not sure if this is the mother or the father, but you can make out, looks like an eyeball hanging out, some bits of the teeth there, a big hole bashed, a few wisps of hair. I mean, it's amazing if you consider what must happen to a person's face when you whack it 40, 41 times with a hatchet. I mean, there's a lot of rage there, I would imagine.
You can see the emotion.
Yeah. And so this huge trial took place. Lizzie was the only one in the house when this happened. And she was put on trial for the murder. And oddly enough, even though everybody felt sure she was guilty, I mean, in fact, she'd been seen going out and purchasing some poison prior to this, which was suspicious, she ended up being acquitted in the trial. And so the public has always sort of had this mindset that she got away with murder. And, of course, the motivation was this large inheritance. But since she was acquitted, it's always been unresolved. And what makes this story even more grim is that now you can go to the house where this occurred, and it's a bed and breakfast. So people actually go and they sleep in these rooms where these horrible, gruesome bodies were discovered. So when Richard and Debbie Sennett went out there to investigate this, they actually formulated a brand new hypothesis about what happened. There's even a timeline listed in this book that goes over point by point all the things that they believed happened. And some of them are based on facts from the case. Some of them are based upon their psychic impressions. And so what I want to do is ask Richard exactly what they did and how confident they feel and what their conclusions were But again, we are not having any success getting Richard sent. So, Richard, if you're out there, give us a call at 800-570-9962. He confirmed yesterday, so let's hope that everything is good to go for him. If he can't call in, then anybody else who's related to this book, feel free to give us a call, because this is something we've been looking forward to discussing. And so I will not let the cat out of the bag, and considering I'm not the expert on this subject, I'm going to set it aside here, and we'll continue trying to get a hold of Richard Sennett. Rob?
George, maybe there's someone related to the lady.
That would be even better, wouldn't it?
That's what I think.
Maybe there is a descendant of the Bordens who would like to get involved with this. And even the publisher, Tim Beckley, is the publisher of this book. And Tim Beckley is a good friend of the show. He is with the publishing company that, well, he owns Inner Light and Global Communications. And he recently sent me this book that I found fascinating, because when you actually open the book, It's set up in a very clear, outlined way regarding each one of the players. And I'll just go ahead and tell you this, just in case we get Richard in here. Here are the suspects in the case. We start with Lizzie Borden. She was 32 years old, an active church worker, and she lived there, again, with her father, sister, and stepmother. Her motive, they said, was hate, that her father had transferred property to her stepmother. The opportunity for her was that she was in the house when both murders took place. Here are the suspicious circumstances for Lizzie. She had tried to buy poison at a drugstore. She claimed Abby, that's the stepmother, had received a note calling her away. And she was also seen burning a stained dress. But again, she was tried for the crime and found innocent. Now we have Emma, who is Lizzie's sister. She was 41, also lived in the house. Her motive was inheritance of the estate and a long-standing hatred of Abby. The opportunity for her was considered as none because she was supposedly visiting friends about 15 miles away. Suspicious circumstances for her, well, a carriage was seen in the road to the house and her alibi was not confirmed. Then we have an overnight house guest named John Morse. Now, this was Andrew's brother-in-law from the first marriage, Lizzie and Emma's uncle. Motive for him, not known, but he did oppose the transfer of real estate to Abby. Opportunity for him, well, he had an airtight alibi for Andrew's murder, but not Abby's. His alibi was good, some said almost too good. And here's another interesting variable we'll throw in here. There was also an unknown stranger. Now, this was a young man who was seen loitering around the Borden house that morning by neighbors, and he was seen over a period of hours. He looked like he was waiting for someone or something. The motive may have been, well, Andrew had many enemies in town because of his work, and suspicious circumstances, well, the doors were locked except for a short period of time at the Borden house. So, if you got all that, you know who some of the essential and integral players were in this murder mystery. And now I believe we do have Richard Sennett with us, the author of this book, Shocking Psychic Solution, The Lizzie Borden Case. And you can learn more about him if you go to speakingofstrange.com. You'll find a link there online to his website and the Amazon listing for this book. Richard Sennett, welcome to Speaking of Strange.
Oh, good. Glad to be here.
Very happy to have you as well. And, boy, what a fascinating job you've done with this book.
Thanks. Glad to like it.
Well, you know, since I'm familiar with your work, I know that you've been in the field for a long time. But for people who don't know anything about you, if you would just let's start with the basics. Tell us a bit about where you're from, where you are, and your description of what you do.
Okay. I am a long time a native Californian. I live in Southern California. Our grandparents came to California in the 20s to help make silent movies. I still have a lot of my family involved in the industry, but I'm not. I don't involve myself with that. But I grew up here, and back in 1978, I saw a ghost, and it was something I hadn't expected, something I didn't even hardly believe in until I saw it. And then since then, I've been trying to find out what ghosts are and what haunted houses are and what psychic phenomena is all about. And in the work I've done, I've met a lot of very unique people, including such notables as Dr. Hans Holzer and D. Scott Rogo, a really great man. We lost a lot, but he passed. And I met my wife, who is a gifted psychic. And at first, we just sort of worked together professionally, but wouldn't you know it, after 2 years of staying the night at old haunted houses and such things and keeping each other warm, we got married. And she has done a lot of work with the police. And so as a historian, because that is my training and background in history and archaeology, I always knew that there were great mysteries in the historic record. You know, what really happened? And things we just don't know. And so I thought, well, maybe Debbie could use her talents to fill in the gaps and suggest an answer to what really happened. Kind of a looking back sort of technique to solve a crime or a mystery. And the first one we attempted was this one, to actually solve the Lizzie Borden case. And we took months to do it, actually. We managed to get artifacts and pictures and things from the Borden house, and the people I knew in Fall River were very helpful in sending all that stuff out there. Now, I've never been there. That's something I got to let people know. And we kind of decided not to go there so as not to be sort of intimidated by the evidence that was there. We wanted to make this pure. And when we went through the sessions, she would go into a trance. She would feel the objects, see the pictures, try to literally go back in time and view what happened. A story came out, and the story was so amazing, I didn't even believe it. It just sounded too far-fetched. But as I began doing the research, because I was a research part of the whole equation, it started to make sense. The whole thing came together, and a unique theory has come forward to who did it and how.
All right, we have to take our first break here, Richard, but I tell you, this is a good place to hold over, because when we come back, I want you to give us a little more background on the case. I mentioned a few facts a little earlier, but let's get a fuller picture of exactly what happened that day and then see how that you and Debbie were able to put these pieces together, because to me, it's fascinating to think that even though we have these cases in the past where the physical evidence is no longer worthy of forensic study, we might still be able to get some answers. And folks, that's what Richard and Debbie Sennett have done with this new book, Shocking Psychic Solution, The Lizzie Borden Case. Again, you'll find links to his website and the book on Amazon.com if you go to speakingofstrange.com. We're going to dig into this deeply when we come back. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. Speaking of Strange, I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. We're digging into the Lizzie Borden case tonight, talking to Richard Sennett about his new book, Shocking Psychic Solution, The Lizzie Borden Case. His website is ghost-stalker.com. That's ghost-stalker.com. And Richard, even though I mentioned some of the basics that I knew about the case and some stuff that I saw in your book, if you would give us sort of a fuller description of exactly what happened on that fateful day and the controversy surrounding it.
Well, it's a classic case because it's a locked room mystery. You see, the father, Andrew Borden, was kind of the American equivalent of Scrooge. Everybody hated this man. He was a money-grubbing, just a hateful man. But he only had one redeeming quality, and that redeeming quality was he loved his daughter, Lizzie. And she, by all accounts, seemed to love him. And they kept their house locked up, even though it's the late 19th century. Most people kept their houses open. This one was locked up because of his many enemies. Now, his wife had died after giving birth to two kids in a Victorian fashion. He had married again. and the stepmother was kind of a cold lady. She just did her job. She's a great cook. She did what she did, but she was not as loving as a true mother. So the two daughters didn't really cotton to her well. Even though, strangely enough, Lizzie and the stepmother had gotten along pretty good until they had a dispute over who would inherit the money of the father. Now, the father was 72, so odds were that he would be passing on pretty soon. So this was a big controversy. Now, what had happened is, he had left for the day, Andrew, to go to the bank and do his various and sundry things.
This is the...
She was home. Now, the sister had gone off to visit a friend, was in another town nearby, and was her, the stepmother, and the servant. They had an Irish servant named Bridget. And they were just at home. It was really, really hot. Nobody felt good because they didn't have good refrigeration, so the food had spoiled. And wouldn't you know it, Abby, the stepmother, went upstairs to make the beds and never came down. Well, they were there working, and wouldn't you know it, the father came home early. He wasn't feeling well himself. Now, that's really strange because this man never came home early. Just this one time he did, that he laid it down on the couch and he turned up dead. Someone had bludgeoned him with an axe, just chopped him up. I mean, he got like 9 blows to the head. He probably was asleep when the attack came, which indicates it was an inside job. Now, in the house is Bridget and Lizzie. Okay, later on, when the doctors came and confirmed that he was dead, they went seeking the mother and discovered her upstairs hacked to death as well. She'd been hacked to death that same morning and probably hacked to death at least an hour and a half before Andrew. Now, who did it? Well, there's only two people in the house, Bridget, who was seen outside washing the windows, and Lizzie, who was inside. In fact, it looked like there was only two people in the house, the murdered people who were dead, and Lizzie Borden. Now, Lizzie was a Sunday school teacher. She was well thought of. She liked her father, had no reason to kill him. So what happened? That was the mystery. Well, they, of course, arrested Lizzie Borden. They looked, and they never found a murder weapon. They found an axe, but it had no evidence on it, and it wasn't the right size or shape. A trial was held, and Lizzie, who had inherited all of her father's money along with her sister, hired the best lawyers they could, including the former governor of Massachusetts. So it was the dream team of her age. And the police blew the investigation. They immediately believed Lizzie did it. They didn't even try anything else. Even though there are all these loose ends, like strangers who'd been seen, a carriage that arrived in the middle of the day, nobody knew about it. People had even, she said she wasn't in the house when the murder took place of her father because she was in the barn. And people had actually seen her in the barn. So what happened? The case fell apart. As a matter of fact, if that case was tried today, she'd probably still get off. Well, she was released, and everyone accused her, though, thought she was the murderess. Well, we did some study on this and found that we think that Andrew wasn't really a target. He had seen something that he couldn't reveal, and so to keep his mouth shut, he was murdered. I think that, our assessment was that Lizzie knew about it and planned to make the hit on the stepmother. So she was guilty up to her ears. And but she didn't kill her father. She loved her father. She didn't want him to die. In fact, everything seemed to be calm and purposeful. There were stories of break-ins that had been circulated, all the stuff. And then when she discovers the father, her father dead, she falls apart. And the stories all collapse. She starts to kind of fake it, make up things as they go. So that's kind of where our story went. I hope that gives you some more data.
Absolutely. And so it shows that there were a lot of confusing aspects in terms of motivation and access. And when Lizzie was acquitted, they just didn't make any attempts to try to determine who'd done this, huh?
No, no attempts were actually made. There were some, of course, her lawyers put out, like in the O.J. trial. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's very similar to the O.J. Simpson trial that we experienced just a little while ago. And, of course, you don't see O.J. looking for the murderers. We don't know. I think she actually knew who did it. And, well, of course, what about Bridget, the nurse?
Yeah.
Well, she went west for a time. She all of a sudden got a lot of money. And she went west. She never went back to Ireland. But she distanced herself from the family. Her sister and Lizzie, Abby, what was her name? I'm getting mixed up here. Mm-hmm. Lizzie and her sister did live together, and they did have a falling out. But there's some very questionable things about what went on. So the full story is not known, and I don't know if it'll ever be truly known, but our attempts to reconstruct what happens using psychic means suggest a solution to the case.
Now, the rest of her life, even though she was acquitted, was Lizzie Borden demonized and viewed as guilty by the public?
Oh, yes. Even though she was a good church-going woman, right after the trial, she went to church, and everyone shunned her.
Now,
she got up and left and never returned to the church again.
When Debbie was reliving these events so intimately and vividly, was this tough for her? I mean, was this a burden to go through this process?
Oh, yeah. In fact, when she does investigations of murder sites, she actually does go out and work with the police, all that. She got so sick, I told her to stop doing it. Because even though her information was helpful to the police, it couldn't be used in a court of law because in the state of California, information gained through psychics is not admissible in court and can be grounds for dismissal. So whenever she worked with the police, it was always written off as an anonymous telephone tip.
Right.
But she would come back and she'd be devastated for a week. And when we were doing these sessions, she'd have to lay off. In other words, she couldn't do one after the other. She actually had to, you know, wait a couple of weeks sometime before she could go back and do it again.
And would Debbie feel as though she were actually right there in the presence of all these living characters?
Yes. In fact, she gets so involved that her face actually changes once she got all... She's talking about this August, you know, and Fall River. It's incredibly hot. She starts to sweat. And it's not even hot in the house, but she was had such an empathetic link to the people and the place, but she was reliving it as if she was just watching over the shoulder of the people involved.
Now, soon we have to take another break, and after that, I want to really dig into the psychic solution. But before we do that, have you been contacted by or had any contact with relatives or family members involved in the case who find this book, controversial?
No, we have not gotten that. In fact, other people have, I've now learned, come up with a similar solution through a variety of different means. There are about 9 or 10 different ideas of what really happened, besides, of course, the standard one that Lizzie did it, somehow managed to get rid of the axe and the bloody clothes and everything else.
And the people who own the Lizzie Borden house now and operate it as a bed and breakfast, do they embrace this solution, or what have you heard from them?
Oh, I haven't really heard much from them at all. As a matter of fact, I was kind of shocked that I didn't hear from them. In fact, Debbie and I would love to go to the house itself and spend the night in one of the bedrooms.
Yeah, boy, that would be intense. Okay, well, when we come back from this break, we are going to get right into it, what the actual shocking psychic solution is that Richard and Debbie have been able to produce in this case that has puzzled and intrigued for so long and created such an indelible impression on the imagination of those who are intrigued by not only crime, but also ghostly activity, ghoulishness. In fact, just recently, I saw an episode of Monster Quest on the History Channel that focused on a small team of paranormal investigators who went into the Lizzie Borden house and were conducting an investigation. Again, if you want to learn more about Richard Sennett, you can go to his website. It is ghost-stalker.com. There's a link to it, as well as a link to this book at speakingofstrange.com. When we come back, we will hear the shocking psychic solution to the Lizzie Borden case. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange. Coming at you from the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains, the oldest in the entire country. You're listening to Speaking of Strange, and you're about to hear the shocking psychic solution to the Lizzie Borden case of the 1890s. You've all heard the nursery rhyme, the jump rope song, whatever you want to call it. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. And yet, she was acquitted. Well, Richard and Debbie Sennett have been working on this case because even though it might be impossible now to go back and look at the physical evidence and draw any conclusions, there is always the possibility of reliving that event psychically, and that's what they have been focused on. That's what you can learn about in this book. And Richard, on page 55 of your book, there is a psychic timeline of the murders, and it includes some events that are based on facts from the case and others that Debbie perceived, and that might be a good reference for us to use as you kind of describe step by step exactly what you and Debbie believe happened here.
Well, I think that both sisters, Emma and Lizzie, were very angry about the disposition of the will and the thought that their inheritance might go to the mother, to the stepmother. Now, Emma's an interesting character. She's kind of avoided by all of the theorists because first she was cold. She had really very few friends. She hated her stepmother. She also didn't like her father very much at all either. Now, our theory, and when I first heard it, it just didn't make sense, was that the one who actually wielded the axe was none other than the sister, Emma. Now, she had an alibi. She was in another town, but nobody ever checked that alibi. And there was, our theory is that she took a carriage, came back early that morning. Lizzie, who was in on the plot, let her in the locked house. She stayed upstairs and murdered the mother, which was the plan. And she took the murder weapon, a long-handled Native American tomahawk that did the job. And unfortunately, the carriage, the person who was supposed to drive her back, was delayed. And unfortunately, her father saw her on the staircase. Of course, she wasn't supposed to be there. And when the mother's body was found, and she was there, and the father would testify to that, she would be, of course, hung. She'd have her head in the noose. So our theory, our solution, is that once the father had seen Emma, the father had to die. And, of course, she still had the murder weapon with her, so it wasn't hard to catch him in the parlor, laying down, give him some story of why she came home early, and then silence him forever. The carriage arrived. She left. Lizzie came in, expecting to start making her alibi so that she could leave the door open or pretend there was a break-in, and that's how the mother had died. Found her father, and just everything collapsed. Everything just fell apart at that point. Anyway, that is our solution to the case, that it was the sister. Now, if the sister had been selected as the person most responsible, she probably would have been hung. Nobody liked her. She was a bitter woman. She had a lot of motive. She had a lot of just hate for both of these people. But no one who knew Lizzie thought this woman could do it. That's the whole thing. So our theory is that Lizzie was a talker. She was not a doer. She liked to talk a good fight, but the idea of actually, you know, doing something was foreign to her. And so that, because she was outgoing and had many friends in the community, most people said, hey, she couldn't have done that. This doesn't make sense. And I think that's how she got off. Of course, Emma got back to the ranch or to the farm where she was staying, ditched the murder weapon. We believe she ditched it down a well, and in fact stayed there until she was notified and was seen as innocent.
Now, considering that Lizzie had purchased poison prior to this, do you think that she ever used that poison on anybody?
No, she didn't purchase poison. She tried to purchase poison, but they wouldn't sell it to her. And it's really ridiculous because she went for prussic acid, where she could have used arsenic, which was quite available. There was a lot of talk about poison, so maybe that was their plan A, was to poison Emma or Abby. But it came down to the, something that had to be done quickly, and they decided on a tomahawk as the way to do it. Quick, deadly, silent. And at that time, because of the Native American wars and the Puritan times, you know, King James War and all that sort of thing, there were lots of tomahawks laying around. Wasn't an uncommon item to be found in New England. Still find them in New England. But that's what they was decided, at least through our description of what was found. Now, they did find an axe in the house, but it didn't fit the wound. In fact, it's really something nobody talks about. The skulls of both Andrew and Abby are still around. We can look at the blows, what was left of their skulls, and by all accounts, they seem to have been delivered by a left-handed person. Lizzie was right-handed. So it seems that there's pretty good evidence. Now, was she innocent? No. She was up to her eyeballs in the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
So our original plan was, our solution is that Abby was the target, but unfortunately the father was hit as well, and so the double murder is what kind of screwed things up. So the planning was intense, but unfortunately, he got sick and threw a fly in the ointment, which caused the mystery we have today.
So now, after Emma hacked them up and got away with it, and then Lizzie was acquitted, what happened to this inheritance the father had?
Well, it went to both of the sisters.
Okay.
And they bought him a beautiful house they called Mycroft. And they lived together until they finally had a falling out. And Lizzie finally moved to New York. And at that point in time, she had a relationship with an actress, which seems to indicate that she was, at least at that point in her life, gay. And that could have had an element to it. Or it could be that she turned towards female people because, well, being Lizzie Borden, who'd want to date you?
Yeah, right.
If you think that she might have killed her father, you don't want to be on the list as well. So that may have been part of the reason we don't know. We do know that she sued this one actress, and it all came in the trial and all that, so it was kind of scandalous. But many people have suggested that that there was an illegitimate son, that Andrew had an illegitimate son from a mistress who came in and did the crime. Some say that Lizzie had a lover, a male lover, who came in, even though the lesbian thing may have put a damper on that theory. But she did have friends and was a social worker in the community and knew some of the down-and-out people who could be induced to kill Andrew Borden or someone else. And he certainly had no friends and many enemies. So there are many solutions. Some say Bridget did it. Some say that she did it in some sort of fit, that she was a bipolar person or she may have had a split personality. And then the big mystery was, how did she get away with not staining her dress? It would have been covered with blood. Well, she did change her dress at one point, but then initially people would have seen it if she was covered in blood. But of course, if she didn't do the actual crime, why should she have any blood? Except for she may have, you know, somehow gotten some blood on her in encountering her sister after the death of the mother, the stepmother. We don't know, but how could she get rid of the weapon, the murder weapon? She seems to have been almost under constant surveillance once the doctor was called and the police came in. So there's a lot of great mysteries about what happened. One theory is that she took off her clothes and murdered everyone in the nude. And then, of course, washed off the blood and then put her clothes back on. That does not sound very Victorian or 19th century at all, or with a prudish person like Lizzie Borden was.
Yeah. Okay, we are up on another break, and boy, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the psychic sense of how this really affected the sisters afterward, because it sounds like that aside from the unexpected circumstances of killing the father, they succeeded quite well in their plan. And, of course, I am talking about the Lizzie Borden murder case from the 1890s. Richard Sennett and Debbie Sennett have written this book, Shocking Psychic Solution, The Lizzie Borden Case. It's laid out very nicely and clearly, and I must warn you, if you get this book, there are some very ghoulish, gory photos in here of the murder victims, and when you see them, it very clearly illustrates the amount of rage and really evil determination that went into both of these murders. It's quite disturbing. You can learn more about Richard Sennett and his book if you go to speakingofstrange.com and follow the links there. I'm Joshua P. Warren. We'll continue on Speaking of Strange right after this. Perhaps a great success for a diabolical duo in American history, Lizzie and Emma Borden, offing their dad and stepmother, and got away with it. It sounds like that's what we're talking with Richard Sennett about right now. We only have a few minutes left in tonight's interview. He is the author of the book Shocking Psychic Solution, The Lizzie Borden Case. Do you think they considered this overall a great success, Richard?
No, not really. In fact, there was a great deal of strain between the two, and they lived together, and though they were acquitted, at least Lizzie was acquitted, the public didn't acquit her. They blamed her, and she was, as they say, shunned and was kind of looked upon as a strange woman, a freak. So her life really wasn't that happy afterwards. She gave a lot of her money to organizations that helped animals, pets like cats and dogs and things like that. She became kind of an advocate for pets and animal societies and toward the end of her life. She would actually go and give money to orphans, and she tried to kind of, I don't know, assuage some of the pain caused by these awful murders. But in a lot of ways, even though she got away with it legally, she didn't get away with it morally. And in the end, her life was a sad and pitiful one. And the same goes for her sister as well. So I think that happens. You may succeed in fooling the judicial system, but justice exists in more places than a courtroom.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we have to face the ultimate trial in front of God himself.
Now, one last question. Considering that Andrew was considered such an unlikable, cold man, and we know that Emma hated his wife, her stepmother, Abby, so much, and there is some kind of demented, perhaps psychosexual aspect to this, do you think that there may have been any kind of an incestuous relationship between Andrew and Emma that would lead Emma to hate Abby so much to kill her?
That's one of the theories, that there was some kind of an incestuous. Of course, that's very much on the mind of modern people, you know, child abuse and things like that. All accounts from what we've learned seems to indicate that there's no evidence, at least in the case of Lizzie, that there was any kind of abuse going on. They certainly, there was no fear, no hate, none of the things that seem to target incest. Again, this is the 19th century. A lot of things were kept secret. It's possible. I just don't think it's probable, and there are solutions that didn't come up.
All right. Well, aside from visiting your website, ghoststalker.com, and again, that's ghost-stalker.com, or checking out this book on Amazon, is there anything else you'd like to pass along to listeners who might want to learn more about you and your work?
Oh, I continue to investigate haunted sites, write about them. In fact, I recently wrote an article for Fate magazine that was published last month. I continue to write the stories and books. Right now, my wife and I are working on perhaps our greatest case. And I don't know if we'll be successful with this. It may take another year to 2 years to finish, and that is the psychic solution to the Jack the Ripper murders.
That's a good one, and I can see the definite similarities between these two cases. I was mentioning earlier that, you know, even looking at the pictures alone, it sort of conjures up images of the Jack the Ripper case.
It was a very grim case, and unlike Lizzie Borden, where you have a very limited amount of suspects of time, this is far more open. No, we don't even know how many women were we even murdered by Jack the Ripper. The official count is 5, but it could be as many as 7 or 9. All we do know is these prostitutes, overaged prostitutes, were murdered in the worst part of London in the middle of 1888. Then all of a sudden the murders stopped. And we're going to try to see what we can do. Now, unlike the Lizzie Borden case, we've actually gone to London. And that, of course, is a great help. And, of course, we've consulted with some people on this. But, again, we hope to find an answer to this great mystery. And perhaps if someone would like us to tackle another mystery, they could get my website or email me if they know of a great case that is unsolved and we'd like to find out an answer to it, have them contact us. Maybe we'll put that as a future endeavor to open the pages of the past, to peer through the veil of history, and reach a solution to the insoluble mysteries of the past.
And considering that time and space are irrelevant, Debbie could sit right there in California and potentially solve a case, right?
Right. Yes, she has.
Yeah.
Actually, recently worked on a case of a missing person in Nevada,
uh-huh.
and we're quite successful yeah. with that. So it's a unique gift she has, and it doesn't always work. I wish it was consistent so it could be something you could depend on, but she's human, and sometimes it doesn't work. But again, we can suggest what might have happened, and maybe lead others into looking at Emma, looking at the case in a different way, and maybe more evidence will come to light. That's what my hope is.
All right. Well, Richard, fine job. This is fascinating stuff, and whether it's accurate or not, it's worth a try. And, you know, what you've concluded here sounds pretty logical to me. So thank you very much for being on the show tonight. When we come back, we will be into the dark 30 hours. And I gave you a cliffhanger a little earlier, folks, about a strange choice that I was given in an odd dream. I'll tell you about that when we return. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange.